Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from The Voice of America. I'm Pete Musto.
And I'm Dorothy Gundy. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear the English Expression Teaching Series, Words and Their Stories, with Ana Mateo. Later, we bring you the American History Series, Making of a Nation. But first, this report. Students hoping to visit the grounds of Western Governors University will not find them. WGU operates entirely over the internet. But that is not its only difference from most other colleges and universities in the United States. It does not have classes or professors either, at least not in the traditional sense. WGU is a private, not-for-profit school that offers study programs leading to a bachelor's or master's degree. Its programs have been approved by educational accrediting agencies. They are accepted through a system known as Competency-Based Education, or CBE. Students in a CBE program, such as the one at Western Governors, choose a central field of study just as they would at a traditional college or university. Yet instead of attending a series of classes led by professors or teaching assistants, the students direct themselves. CBE programs require students to demonstrate their understanding of a given set of skills. Students must prove their mastery of skills that relate to their field of choice through self-study and use of their existing knowledge of the subject. The programs also require them to prove their mastery by taking exams on those skills. Once they have demonstrated all the skills their study program requires, the students earn their degree. Marnie Baker Stein says the people who set up Western Governors University in 1997 knew there would be a growing need for different methods of higher education. Stein is the chief academic officer at WGU. Stein told VOA that in recent years, more and more non-traditional students have been entering U.S. higher education. Many are people who decided to attend college later in life, instead of right after high school, as most Americans who go to college do. They also include men and women who may have attended college at one point, but left without earning a degree.
Most non-traditional students have full-time jobs, notes Stein. They see higher education as the best path towards getting better jobs and improving their positions in life. But they need to do so at a rate that works for them and their day-to-day activities. In the United States, most traditional colleges and universities operate around set time periods. Classes usually start in the late summer and end in the spring of every year. These academic calendars are usually divided into two or three study terms, each lasting around 15 weeks. Stein notes that in a CBE program, students can start any time they want. If students work hard, they can finish a class as soon as they successfully complete the final skills test, meaning they can earn their degree faster than in a traditional academic program. Western Governors students might not sit in classrooms with professors for several hours a week. But Stein says each class has one or more teachers who communicate with students over the internet. These instructors guide the students through their self-study and offer help whenever they need it. There are also plenty of special materials to improve the self-learning experience. The materials can include videos, writing projects, and computer software programs. Stein adds that each WGU student has a university representative working with them throughout their entire program. This person follows their progress and makes sure they choose the right classes. And people responsible for the final exams provide complex and helpful criticism for students who fail. So our students aren't on a physical campus, Stein said, but they are surrounded by this community of care that is able to personalize their interactions with them in very powerful ways.
Western Governors reports that it serves over 113,000 students, both in and outside the United States. And CBE programs are slowly growing in popularity around the country. Kelly Parsons studies CBE programs for the American Institutes for Research, a nonprofit group with offices in Washington, D.C. She argues that CBE programs are nothing new, and that U.S. educators have been experimenting with them since the 1970s. However, CBE has been getting more attention recently than it may ever have in the past, even if that popularity has not grown as much as some had expected over the last 5 years. Last year, Parsons' organization asked officials at 501 U.S. colleges and universities about their opinions on CBE. The group released its findings last month. A total of 57 schools were shown to be operating some form of CBE program. About 85% of all the higher education officials said they were either currently designing a CBE program at their school or were considering doing so. Parsons says growing interest in CBE comes from the increased debate over three major issues facing American higher education: access, cost, and quality. CBE programs have made use of many new technologies, she adds. This helps reduce barriers for non-traditional and other students by bringing higher education to them. And programs that permit students to work at their own speed may save students money by reducing the time it takes for them to earn a degree. Also, Parsons says many companies struggle in placing value on what a job candidate may have learned from a psychology or history study program, for example.
Employers are not satisfied just knowing that someone has a degree, she said. They want to know what skills they have. CBE classes are based on mastering a skill, like how to solve a given security problem or write a project proposal instead of a general area of knowledge. So a student's academic records show exactly what skills they offer to an employer rather than just a grade point average. But some educators have concerns about the value of the education CBE programs offer. Johan Niem is a professor of U.S. history and higher education policy at Western Washington University in Bellingham, Washington. Niem argues that the purpose of higher education is not simply to help students earn a degree. It should teach students how to think critically, understand the subjects they are studying more deeply, and see how they are connected to other subjects. That way, they can put the knowledge to better use. You don't need to just master a set of skills or a small body of knowledge, he said. You need to explore, think, get shaken, have a conversation, struggle. And those things take time. They take relationships. They take actually being in an environment where those are the most valuable things. The promises of easier access and lower cost will likely make CBE programs more desirable for students from poor families, says Neem. But as the quality of the education in these programs may be lesser, low-income students may not actually be any better off in the end. Instead of supporting CBE, he adds, policymakers and educators should look for ways to improve access and reduce costs for traditional higher education. I'm Dorothy Gundy.
And I'm Pete Musto.
Now, the VOA Learning English Program, Words and Their Stories. Today, we talk about an amazing animal and an expression it has given us, the crocodile. First, why are they amazing? Well, crocodiles are experts at survival. Scientists say they first appeared 200 million years ago and have outlived the dinosaurs by some 65 million years. One reason they are such good survivors is that they can go for a very long time without eating. And they are expert hunters. They use their strong jaws to bite their prey, and then they swallow their food whole. Here's another fun fact about crocodiles. When they lose a tooth, they grow one right back. A crocodile can go through 8,000 teeth in one lifetime. Okay, while these facts are fascinating, they really do not help to explain today's expression, crocodile tears. Simply put, crocodile tears are fake sadness. You pretend to cry and feel badly for something when, in fact, you could not care less. A great word to describe crocodile tears is insincere. But don't take my word for it. Let's hear country western singer Dale Watson sing his song, Crocodile Tears.
Crocodile tears, they're tearing me apart. I know they're not sincere, still they break my heart.
But why do tears from an ancient, unfeeling reptile mean false sadness? Well, the expression crocodile tears comes from an old myth that crocodiles would shed tears while eating their prey. Writers on the website crocodilian.com claim that this myth was in use by the 1200s. A religious worker from that time wrote that if a crocodile found a man by the water, it would kill him if it could. Then the crocodile would cry tears on the man, but then finally swallow him. Another myth about crocodile tears suggests the animals are very crafty indeed. Crocodiles, the story goes, would cry tears as a false show of guilt or grief to trick their prey. The prey would come closer and then become dinner. Of course, we know now that these stories are not true. Scientists explain that crocodiles do create tears. The fluid helps to clean its eyes. But crocodiles do not cry. crying is purely emotional and is reserved for us humans. So that is the origin of the phrase crocodile tears. Now let's talk about how and when to use it. This is a common expression, and we use it in any situation. So I could say it to my best friend as easily as I could to colleagues at work. But please note, you do not have to have actual tears flowing down your face to have crocodile tears. If you fake sadness or regret by using only words, others can still accuse you of having crocodile tears. One last note about this expression. Sometimes crocodile tears are worse than insincere. Sometimes they are also hypocritical. Those are the times you are showing sadness, but actually, in your heart, you are quite happy about the situation. And that's all the time we have for Words and Their Stories. Until next time, I'm Anna Mateo. Those crocodile tears.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. President Abraham Lincoln led the Union of Northern States in 4 years of civil war against the Southern Confederacy. But he did not live to see the end of the war. He did not live to see the nation reunited. He was assassinated in April of 1865. Shep O'Neill and Morris Joyce tell what happened after Lincoln died.
Almost immediately, officials began planning details of the president's funeral. They asked Mrs. Lincoln where she wanted her husband buried. At first, she said Chicago. That was where the Lincolns were going to live after they left the White House. Then she said the Capitol building in Washington. A tomb had been built there for America's first president, George Washington, but it had never been used. Finally, she remembered a country cemetery they had visited. At the time, her husband had said, "When I am gone, lay my remains in some quiet place like this." So Mrs. Lincoln decided that the president's final resting place would be in the quiet, beautiful Oak Ridge Cemetery outside their hometown of Springfield, Illinois.
For several days after Lincoln's assassination, his body lay in the East Room of the White House. The room was open to the public all day. Next, the body was taken to the Capitol building. Again, the public could come to say goodbye. Then the body was put on a special train for the trip back to Illinois. 4 years earlier, President-elect Lincoln had traveled by train from Illinois to Washington. He stopped to make speeches in cities along the way. Now, on this sad return trip, the train stopped at those same cities: Baltimore, Philadelphia, New York, Cleveland, Indianapolis, Chicago.
In every town, people lined the railroad. They stood silently with tears in their eyes as the train moved slowly past. Farmers working in the fields saw the train and dropped to their knees in prayer. For the wise man who had led the Union through 4 years of bloody civil war, Father Abraham, was dead. Churches throughout the country held memorial services. Ministers told their people that God had taken Lincoln because the president had completed the job God had given him. He had brought peace to the Union and freedom to all men.
The final service was at the cemetery outside Springfield. It ended with the words from Lincoln's second inaugural speech. With malice toward none, with charity for all, with firmness in the right, as God gives us to see the right, let us strive on to finish the work we are in. Let us heal the nation's wounds. Let us do all possible to get and keep a just and lasting peace among ourselves and with all nations.
While the nation mourned Lincoln's death, federal officials investigated his assassination. The man who had shot Lincoln in Ford's Theater was an actor, John Wilkes Booth. He had fled the theater after the murder. The government offered a reward of $100,000 to anyone who captured Booth and his helpers. The investigation produced the names of several people who were friends of Booth. One was John Surratt. Like Booth, he supported the Southern Confederacy during the Civil War. Another was David Harold, a young man who worked in a store in Washington. Others were George Atzerodt, Louis Payne, Sam Arnold, and Michael O'Loughlin. Most of these men had stayed at a house owned by John Surratt's mother, Mary.
One by one, in the days following Lincoln's death, these people were arrested. Anyone else who might have had a part in the plot was seized. Soon, hundreds of suspects were being held in jails in and around Washington. At the end of a week, only two of the plotters were still free, David Harold and John Wilkes Booth. Booth broke his leg when he jumped from the presidential box to the stage at Ford's Theater. A few hours later, he and Harold stopped at the home of a Dr. Samuel Mudd. They reportedly gave the doctor false names. They asked him to fix Booth's broken leg. Dr. Mudd agreed, and he let the two men sleep at his home. Federal troops chasing the assassins arrested the doctor. They accused him of being part of the plot.
John Wilkes Booth and David Harold ran and hid for 6 days. They crossed the Potomac River from Maryland into Virginia. Finally, 12 days after the assassination of Abraham Lincoln, soldiers found the two men. They were hiding in a tobacco barn near the town of Port Royal. Harold agreed to surrender. He came out of the barn with his hands in the air. He shouted again and again that he was innocent. Booth refused to come out. The soldiers set fire to the barn.
The fire forced Booth to move close to the door. The soldiers could see him now. He was aiming a gun at them. The soldiers had been ordered to capture Booth alive. But one of them raised his gun and shot Booth in the neck. The actor fell. Some of the soldiers ran to the burning barn and pulled him out. They carried him to a nearby house. He died 2 hours later.
John Wilkes Booth carried a notebook. He wrote in it every day. On the day Lincoln was killed, he wrote, "For 6 months we had worked to kidnap Lincoln, but with the Confederacy being almost lost, something decisive and great must be done. I struck boldly. Booth described how and why he had shot the president. Our country, Booth wrote, owed all her troubles to him, and God simply made me the instrument of his punishment. Booth's body was returned to Washington. Men who knew him confirmed that it was the body of John Wilkes Booth. The body was buried under the stone floor of the Washington prison. A few years later, his family received permission to move the body to a cemetery in the city of Baltimore.
Evidence showed that only a few people were actually involved in the plot against the president. Most had agreed to work with Booth because they believed he planned to kidnap Lincoln, not kill him. Of the hundreds of persons arrested, only 8 were brought to trial. The Secretary of War decided that they would be tried by a military court. He argued that Lincoln had been commander-in-chief of all military forces and had been murdered during wartime.
The trial began almost 2 months after the assassination. The prisoners seemed in poor condition. All wore heavy chains on their arms and legs, and the men had been forced to wear thick cloths over their heads. Officials said the cloths were necessary to prevent them from talking to each other. The Secretary of War announced that the prisoners could not meet privately with their defense lawyers. They could meet only in the courtroom. Guards could hear everything they said. One of the defense lawyers recognized that the job was hopeless. He said the trial was a contest between the defense lawyers and the whole United States. There was no question, he said, what the military court's decision would be.
The government tried to prove that Lincoln's assassination was a Confederate plot. Witnesses told how Confederate supporters reportedly planned to cause trouble in the North. But none could prove that Confederate President Jefferson Davis, or any other Southern leader, played a part in Booth's plot to kill Lincoln. 400 witnesses appeared. Many of the important ones had been arrested as suspects. They agreed to give evidence if the government dropped the charges against them. For 6 weeks, the court heard evidence against the 8 prisoners. The prisoners themselves could say nothing. They could only listen.
In late June 1865, the trial of Abraham Lincoln's assassins ended. The military officers serving as judges met secretly for 2 days. Then they announced their decision. All 8 prisoners were found guilty. One received a prison sentence of 6 years. 3 were sentenced to life in prison. 4 were sentenced to die. Defense lawyers appealed for mercy. The appeal was rejected. On July 7th, David Herold, Louis Payne, George Atzerodt, and Mary Surratt were hanged for the murder of Abraham Lincoln.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Pete Musto,
And I'm Dorothy Gundy.